Our fifth principle is the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. This is the fifth of the seventh principles that we've been devoting special Sundays to, both for my comment and lay-led comment as well, and hopes to reboot our commitment and understanding of what a Unitarian Universalist congregation is and ought to be and can be, and to finally then take a look at our mission and re-examine that. This principle may be the key to all of them. It's kind of in the middle. The ones before that relate more to individual beliefs and approaches to life. The last three are more communal. And this one really is both. It kind of links them together. It is the answer, it's the Unitarian Universalist answer to what in philosophy and theology is called the problem of authority. That is, how does an individual or how does a group of people know what's right? Know what to do. Different religions, different ideologies and philosophies have come up with a lot of different answers to that question. God or gods, the book, the tribe, the law, the words of the prophet, will, love. And even from those big capitalized nouns come other derivative forms of authority. Who interprets the words of the prophet? Who is authorized to carry on the words of God? For Unitarian Universalists, the problem of authority is the right of conscience and the democratic process. There are antecedents in history for us. One is Michael Servetus, burned at the stake in 1553 for his essay, The Errors of the Trinity. Really, all of the radical Reformation, the Anabaptists and the Waldensians and all those folks, are our religious and philosophical and theological progenitors. The American Revolution and the Enlightenment philosophy that brought that to bear certainly is part of it, being against both papal and royal authority. That's why so many founding mothers and fathers of the United States were Unitarian and Universalist. There's a quote that I see on the internet once in a while from John Q. Adams about believing in the absolute separation of church and state. And when I see that, I always say, like the good Unitarian he was. But yet, he was his first year of presidency was 1825. And up until 1821, there was an established church in Massachusetts where he lived. If you were a member of a church in a first parish in Massachusetts, the meeting house that you met in was built and maintained by public taxes. The minister of the parish church, his salary was paid for by public taxes. So it wasn't until 1825 that was overturned in Massachusetts. So the separation of church and state certainly means different things in different times, even within the United States. Now, one thing that has not changed for Unitarians and Universalists is that right of conscience and freedom of belief. This goes back way, way before the Unitarian Association. There were always clauses wherever Unitarians met that were called the Liberty Clause, an escape hatch, in other words, because Unitarians were given to statements of faith, and along with every statement of faith, there was always a liberty creed that basically said, neither this nor any other statement shall be imposed as a creedal test. And this is hard for people outside of Unitarian Universalism to grasp, because one of the first things people ask then about any religion or approach to religion is, what do you believe? And for Unitarian Universalists, it's really not what we believe, it's how we believe it. We can say even about these principles, well, this is what most of us believe most of the time. That's the best we can do. The other value of the democratic process has also been around for a long, long time, but it has changed more over the years than the right of conscience. For instance, that democratic process has expanded over the years to include those not originally included in what Unitarians thought would be the democratic process. Women, slaves, African Americans, gay, the gay community, lesbian, bi, transgender folks, a lot of people have been included in that democratic process of what Unitarian Universalists believe that weren't included at some point earlier in the history. There have also been changes internally. There's a thing within Unitarian Universalism called congregational polity, that each congregation is autonomous and no outside organization can tell it what to do. That's a very, very fundamental value in Unitarian Universalism. But that has changed over the years. But to show you how strong it was and how strong it still is in some ways, in 1963, shortly after the merger of the Unitarians and Universalists, there was a motion at the General Assembly for our congregations to include an anti-discrimination clause that Unitarian Universalists could not discriminate on the basis of race or color. 1963. It was defeated. It was defeated because the feeling of congregational polity was so strong that it was not thought that even for a cause as good as this, it was not the right of the General Assembly to impose such a clause on the congregations. Now, at that point, you might say that congregational polity became an idol that deserved to be taken down and dusted off a little bit. But I'm just saying that's where congregational polity was in 1963. And in some ways, still is, though it has been weakened over the years in some ways. For instance, one landmark of congregational polity is, you know how it says that grand juries can indict a ham sandwich? Not always, but they can, right? Well, Unitarian Universalist churches can ordain a ham sandwich. Unitarian Universalist churches can ordain anybody they want, and the UUA can say nothing about it. Okay, that's congregational polity. However, as a practical matter, the Unitarian Universalist Association has very significant and hard to attain criterion to be an official fellowship with the UUA. You have to go through 3 years of divinity school, an internship. You have to know about this Michael Servetus guy and all sorts of stuff. You have to be at least schooled enough in group congregational process that you don't get shot out of the saddle your first year. You know, that sort of stuff. It takes a lot of training to be a credentialed Unitarian Universalist minister. And if a congregation calls somebody that's not in that fellowship, oh, you can do it. But don't expect a lot of cooperation for the UUA as long as that person is minister. Okay, so there's a reality there, you know, of which congregational polity gets sort of ameliorated, changed, evolved. District staff people serving more than one congregation. There is now something called the Common Endowment Fund, which simply makes it easier to administer until it sort of got really weird in this last year. But a lot of congregations sort of pooled their resources in kind of like a giant mutual fund. Boy, you couldn't have done anything like that 20 years ago. It was almost like your money would get cooties if it touched the money of another congregation. You know, that it was really a big deal. There's now a movement not only within Unitarian Universalism, but within Protestantism in general, of what they call multi-site churches. Okay, now usually that has to do with not so much around here, but in the Midwest and the West, when Unitarian Universalist congregations are far and few between, there may be a fairly large congregation in Kansas City, say, and there's not enough of a critical mass to start an independent congregation in some of the suburbs. So some of these larger churches have started to send off multi-sites, where sometimes the sermons are showed on Skype or through electronic media and so forth. So they're not independent congregations. They're sort of part of the home congregation. That's a new thing for us, and it's a new thing in terms of congregational polity. So it's still highly regarded for us. And the reason that it is that there's no bishop. You know, there's a district executive who can advise us, but there's no bishop or cardinal or pope who is going to say that we have to have this minister or we have to do this, that, or the other. Now, this is pretty important. A word here about the power and authority of a minister in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. It's not bestowed, it's acquired, to the extent it's acquired at all, through reason and persuasion. Very little, if any, authority is granted a UU minister by virtue of ordination, calling, or office. I might also say that it's my experience that often a UU minister acquires power and authority through personality. I suggest that's not the best way for it either to be acquired or bestowed. Unitarian Universalist congregations get no money from above. We do give some money to support staff services, district services, religious education materials, and so forth. And again, that can work both ways. We need a new HVA system. We're working on it. We're getting no help from the Archdiocese. By the same token, if we were Catholic or Presbyterian, we might have been already closed. A lot of smaller congregations in the Presbyterian Church and a lot of smaller parishes in the Catholic Church have been closed down. And if I was a bishop or a cardinal, I would understand why. You know, in New York, as you know, the Catholic population is gradually going uptown. And they're giving more support to the larger congregations that are uptown and closing or trying to close a lot of the ones that are farther downtown. So, for better or worse, congregational polity allows us to be here. Now, what does freedom of conscience in the democratic process mean as a practical matter, day to day and year to year in a congregation? As a group, it means we support your freedom of conscience. And as part of the democratic process, you respect the will of the majority. The flame and the chalice. Individual rights and the community rights, they go together. You have things you can rightly expect from a congregation, and the congregation has some things it can rightly expect from you. As the Reverend Parisa Parsa said in the reading, the fifth principle preserves the right of conscience, not the right of ego. Now, as in the Alcoholic's Prayer, the wisdom to know the difference is key. It's not always given to us to know the difference when we need to know. Nor, when we need to know, are we always completely open to hearing it from other people. So we do have the obligation to check in with ourselves about our motivations. And I don't think any check-in is 100% clear, but it seems to me, if there's something you would like to see done in a congregation, if for some reason you feel you have to be the one that does it, maybe there's a little bit of ego involved there. If there's something that you want done that you'd really like to see done and you're willing to help and shoulder a lot of the responsibility in order to get it done, but you're more than happy to have somebody else do it, then that may be a little more consciousness of the congregation at large. My grandmother had a phrase that said, it got done and I didn't do it. Which is usually a triumphant meaning that something she'd been doing for years that she thought she couldn't get anybody else to do, finally somebody else picked up on it and she was happy not to do it anymore. So, we understand that when we make decisions as a congregation, the way we make them is very important. And the way we hold them is important and will never be perfect. We ought not to have winners and losers following congregational votes, but rather a respected majority and a respected minority. That said, It is a fact of life in a group that with respect to the democratic process, it is unwise to move on all issues in the same way, having obtained a majority vote. Well, what I mean by this is, no minister in his or her right mind would accept a call to be a minister with an 80% approval. You know, if you took a vote and it came back that 80% approved you and 20% didn't, you can't start a ministry that way. Those 20 people don't like you, they'll get you. You need more than that. You need about, it depends on the group, but you need about 90%. By the same token, don't ask for unanimity. A lot of Unitarian Universalist congregations have almost an allergic reaction to a unanimous vote. I've been in groups where somebody's got to object. Somebody's got to vote no. Somebody's got to vote. Okay, I'll vote no. Okay, 99-1, it passes. Because they just, we're such dissenters that when we get together as a congregation of dissenters, we want that preserved. So don't ask for 100% vote on anything. Now, major capital improvements or changes in address, you really need a supermajority for those sorts of things. I know several decades ago, this congregation was considering moving from this area over to some land that they'd bought in Toad Hill. That never happened. And I know one of the reasons it never happened, I know that even if they got a majority, they just didn't get enough people to really do something that monumental. So some things take more than a majority if you're really going to do it. Now, other issues can be safely decided by even a slim majority. Officer elections at annual meetings, budgets, annual calendar events. These are all so fluid and changeable that a budget particularly gets approved on a particular day. 2 days later, there may be circumstances that budget's out the window. The key to voting some things has to do with keeping your eye on it. I vote for this today. What's the circumstances tomorrow or next month? Now, I would say beginning in sort of the mid-90s, through, I think, the influence of feminist theology, there was a growing appreciation of consensus as a rule and guide in organizing decisions. Now, strictly, a consensus means that a decision is not made until everybody's on board with it. And what that enables the group to do is it can file things down pretty fine. There's a lot of give and take, and then you finally get some sort of reasonable compromise that everybody can buy into. Now, that's fine. However, it's my experience that consensus only works in relatively small groups with a high level of trust. It's not useful for congregational votes, either formally or informally. Yet time and time again, I have seen the search for near consensus or unanimity keep a congregation from moving and give immense power to their most intransigent members. Often these members will threaten withholding their dollars if they're major givers, or pose tacit threats to act out in bullying or other inappropriate ways. Here, congregations need to affirm any member's right to dissent, but also the congregation's obligation to democratic process, not to consensus, and not to the opposition of a determined few. It is important for members to understand that there is authority in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. It goes like this. The democratic process in which the entire membership has a vote is the ultimate authority. The congregation, through its bylaws, delegates authority to its elected officers and trustees. The president of the board appoints chairs of committees which help do the work of, not themselves, but the work of the congregation. The committee chairs choose members of their committees from amongst the members of the congregation. Members have the obligation to respect the work of officers, board members, committees, and officers. My God, we change roles all the time. You know, what's the point of being anti-authoritarian toward anybody who's in a position of authority in this congregation, since it's probably going to be you in a couple years anyhow? You know, treat the board, treat the officers, treat everybody the way you want to be treated. Just taking on a position of authority in this congregation doesn't give you any particular wisdom, nor does it remove any. The board and committees have the obligation to work in the best interest of the congregation, not on their own. Officers, committee chairs, and committee members ought to be changed frequently, and some must be changed frequently according to the wise term limits in the bylaws. Just because Unitarian Universalism does not require a creed, it doesn't mean that we believe in nothing. And just because Unitarian Universalist congregations do not follow an ecclesiastical authority over them, it doesn't mean that congregations do not have a process by which the work of the church is done and which deserves understanding and respecting. Freedom of conscience and the democratic process also has implications for how our members and congregations relate to society at large. And this may be the single most important part of any of our principles. Servetus died at the stake. Joseph Priestley and John Murray and others were imprisoned, requiring them to leave their homeland because of their beliefs. We know that two of our members died at Selma. The Revolutionary War, frankly, was waged on Unitarian values. We have often discussed Unitarian roles in the abolition movement, in the civil rights movement, in the Unitarian minister Norbert Chapek, who died at Auschwitz, the publishing of the Pentagon Papers, and the standing on the side of love for gay marriage and affirming the substance of the recent General Assembly resolution, Black Lives Matter. And so as we struggle with supporting individual freedom of conscience for our members, each of us, I hope, struggles with their own relationship to the congregation, how one contributes, how one looks upon the contributions of others. We also have a principled responsibility to support freedom of conscience, not freedom of ego, in the democratic process in society at large. This is our evangelism. This is our salvation. This is our ground of being and our heaven above.